W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. The Texas coast is bracing for Alberto. This man is visiting Galveston and didn't plan for up to 10 inches of rain.
We had to start changing plans for what we're going to do for the rest of the week.
The tropical storm now in the Gulf of Mexico is the first named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season. Cal Fire says wildfires are up 9% this spring, but acres burned are almost 1,500% up, more than this time last year. Heavy rain and hail tonight around an evacuated village in New Mexico, threatened by wildfires which have killed at least two. A search continues for a suspected murderer on the loose in Arkansas. Authorities believe Stacy Lee Drake bought camping gear and remains in the Morrilton area.
Just a few feet away or yards away, and didn't even know about it until early morning.
Michelle Cheek owns the bar, and she says she is keeping her doors and windows locked tight. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. DNA testing confirms an arm found on an Illinois beach belonged to Shardae Robinson. Maxwell Anderson is accused of killing and dismembering the 19-year-old Milwaukee area technical college student in April. Other remains were found at different places around southeast Wisconsin. A big explosion Wednesday morning rocked downtown Madison and Civic Media's John and Gordy show. Savannah Tomei Olson reports.
John and Gordy were about to wrap up their show when
they do crank up your...
Good Lord.
Well, what was that?
It shook nearby buildings, including Short Stack Eatery. Co-owner Sinead McHugh talked to our Gordy Young.
I totally thought it was thunder.
Two construction workers were hurt, but they're expected to be okay. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
It is absolutely disgusting for conservatives to suggest that because someone is poor or struggling, that they lack judgment. If anybody needs morality policing, it's rich folks, for crying out loud, not people who are struggling to put food on the table and keep a roof over their heads.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Yesterday on the program, I said that I view that we're at a 1980 kind of moment, at a crossroads, if you will, and pondered what kind of a country we would have been, you know, had Reagan not won in 1980 and not ripped the solar panels off the White House and, you know, stuck us with oil for the next, you know, here we are, many years. Wondered what it would be like, you know, had we invested in the technology that we created and built out that technology to where now the norm would be solar panels on every home built, every warehouse, every store, where we're generating all of our electricity needs through renewable sources, and we could tell OPEC to go pound sand. I kind of wondered that. Someone then emails me and goes, Can you do that with 2016? And to be honest, yeah, because as they pointed out, right now we'd be in the last months of Hillary's second term. We would have a Supreme Court that was flipped the other way. Instead of right-wing lunacy and right-wing craziness, we would have a 6-3 liberal Supreme Court. We wouldn't have overturned Roe versus Wade. We wouldn't have destroyed Janus. We wouldn't have undone a whole bunch of regulatory oversight. We wouldn't have seen the pendulum swing back to the wealthy, the powerful, the corporate interest, as we've seen over these last, 7.5 years. There would be another 300 plus federal court appointees who wouldn't be deciding nonsense. I can guarantee that there wouldn't have been any of them who the Bar Association would have rated unqualified. It's what we saw during the Trump years. We wouldn't see the attacks that we lived through under Donald Trump on workers' rights to organize, on workers' rights as a whole. Wouldn't have seen any of that. We wouldn't have seen January 6th. So as voters, it's up to us. We chose where we are. And as I said, you know, about my thoughts of 1980, we were sold this idea that Reagan was going to be the guy, the great savior. And the economy was going to be wonderful. We were going to give rich people all that they could possibly want. And it would trickle down on us like manna from heaven. How's that worked for us? How have we done? Quite frankly, I fear 2024, another one of those moments. Another one of those moments where you look back, you know, 1980, 2000, 2016. We're a different country if the elections go the other way. And corporate America understands this. They do. Because they get us to focus on things that aren't as important. In 1980, they made Carter look weak. A guy who actually served in the military and was actually an officer and established, basically a hero. You know, someone who, there's some incredible stories out there about Jimmy Carter and his service. Ronald Reagan played a soldier on TV. In fact, you know, talked about some of his days of service as if they were real. I look at where we're heading, and it's frightening. And for me, there's no choice here. Trump is not a viable choice. And working people need to remember what happened during his term. And for me, the Department of Labor is that little petri dish, that little window. The difference being Trump wanted a guy named Andy Puzder to be the Secretary of Labor, a guy who was the CEO of Carl's Jr., a guy who had made the first workerless fast food restaurant, totally automated. He's going to be the guy that Trump wanted to be the head of the Department of Labor. Now, it came out he was allegedly a wife beater and a horrible person, and he resigned. And then in comes Antonin Scalia's kid, Eugene, a corporate lawyer, a Walmart lawyer, someone who spent his entire career going after workers and their rights. That's who became Trump's Secretary of Labor. Compare that to who Joe Biden chose. First, Marty Walsh, or Marty Walsh, who had spent his career as someone who fought for workers' rights, was the head of the building trades in Boston for years, became mayor, and then eventually Secretary of Labor, and did some really good things. And his replacement is Acting Secretary Julie Sue, again, someone who has spent her entire life fighting for workers' rights. The difference, very clear. One side, you've got the anti-worker folks. The other side, you've got the pro-worker folks. If you're a working person, you're somebody who punches a clock, you're someone who goes to work every day and is worried that you might not come home, that you might get sick on the job, you might get hurt, you might get killed. There doesn't seem to be a choice here. The people who will oversee your agency, who don't believe in it and want to destroy it, constrain it, hold it down, defund it, or the people who want to make sure that you go home at the end of the day to your family and in the condition that you left home in. We should be funding the Occupational Safety and Health Administration at much higher levels. We should be funding the wage and hour division at the Department of Labor at much higher levels. And there's another example. During the Trump years, the person who was in charge of the wage and hour division, the people who were supposed to make sure that you don't get your wages stolen, the people who oversee minimum wage and overtime and child labor, family medical leave and all that stuff, the person who was in charge of that during the Trump years, someone who was accused of wage theft. Why am I not surprised? Biden's choice is a woman who spent her life fighting for workers as an attorney for the Minnesota building trades. Simple. You think about the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA. Trump's guy was a coal CEO. Biden's guy is actually someone who came out of the coal industry from the worker's side. And we can go through agency after agency and say, which side are they on? We've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to give deference to business leaders, to corporate leaders, because somehow we're told that, well, they're much smarter than those government people. And we're told that, you know, the Trump years were great. I keep having people tell me, you know, the Trump economy was the best ever. And, you know, it got me thinking. I responded the one day, I go, you know, I'm a huge Broncos fan. And for all my Broncos fans, listeners out there, you know, it would be like me saying, you know, the Broncos, you know, they were just an incredible Super Bowl team when they played the Giants and the 49ers because in the first quarter, they were up 10-0. You know, they were kicking their behinds. The best game ever. Now, I didn't watch the rest of it because at the end of the game, well, the one that was 55-10, they lost and won, and 45-10, they lost in another. So if I just focus on the first quarter, it was great. Greatest game ever. But when you look at the whole game or the whole economy during the Trump years, it wasn't great. So let's at least be honest about reality. And for me, this moment, putting them on the scale, balancing who, for me, it seems pretty simple. You know, Joe Biden has workers at the center of his agenda, the center of his mind. That's the focus, and that's what we should want. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as you know, more than 100 workers are killed on the job every week here in the United States, due mostly to traumatic injuries suffered while performing their jobs. Everything from falls to electrocutions, forklift to semi-truck accidents, explosions and poisonings. Oh my. And those are just the people who got up in the morning, brushed their teeth, drove to work, punched in, and didn't get to go home. That's not the estimated 20 times that amount who die from long-term workplace exposure every week. And look, you know, the reality is we can do better. It comes down to who you put into the positions who are overseeing our workplaces. And if you take it seriously, and here to share some thoughts on maybe how we bring this number down, I've asked Jordan Barab to come talk with us, the former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant of Secretary of Labor for OSHA during the Obama years. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here, Rick.
I don't see an awful lot of reporting on the death of workers. I know it happens every day. I know there are tragedies all across the country. Your website, jordanbarrett.com/confinedspace, is like the go-to for bad news. You're like the master of disaster reporting. And look, I think it's an important thing that you do, and I think people should pay attention to this, because sadly, people get up every day to go to work and they don't come home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you know, you don't hear about it usually in the paper, unless it's some kind of mass casualty event where, you know, 5 or 10 workers are killed. It's rare that you'll hear on any given day about workers being killed on the job. Usually it's one at a time, one worker at a time. There may be an article in the local newspaper, maybe not. Often it doesn't even have the worker's name or, you know, what the circumstances were, and then it's just kind of forgotten. Everybody loses interest in it. But I think, you know, given that how many workers are killed every week on the job, it's our responsibility to not only to recognize that that's happening, but also as much as possible to know their names, to say their names, and to understand what's happened and how it can be prevented.
And to hold people accountable. I mean, yeah, I was just, Facebook just reminded me, we had done a labor history tour 11 years ago, back in 2013, and we stopped by the West Texas site where in April of 2013, you had that explosion at the fertilizer plant there that killed several workers and fire people, and basically devastated this part of the community. And it was one of these things that just made me think about, you know, it could happen so quickly. And, you know, no matter how much planning you do, you know, you still need somebody overseeing it. And I remember, and the reason I wanted to bring this up is I remember the response of the attorney general. I think it was the attorney general at the time in Texas that said they didn't need to regulate more. That if you really wanted to know what the company across the street was putting in, you know, in their facilities, just go over and ask them. And I remember going, it doesn't work that way.
No, it certainly doesn't. You know, it's very hard to know what goes on in workplaces. Unfortunately, even workers in the workplaces don't necessarily know what they're working with or how dangerous it is. In the West Texas case, you know, a lot of those killed were emergency responders, and they didn't know what was in necessarily in there, nor what the hazards were, nor how to deal with a fire in that establishment. And consequently, I think 12 emergency responders were killed in that explosion.
Yeah, and, you know, and I remember at the time, what I kept saying at the time was, you know, who knew that putting, you know, I think it was ammonium nitrate in a hot shed, in a hot box, in the Texas heat without a sprinkler system, who knew that was a bad idea?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's this kind of stuff that makes you go, this is why we need regulators. This is why you need inspections. And what we know is for OSHA to go and inspect every workplace in this country would take a couple of lifetimes to do.
Yeah, exactly. I think the AFL-CIO estimated, I think the figure now is if OSHA were to investigate every workplace just once, it would take something like 186 years. And what that means is that unless, you know, a worker is killed in your workplace or the workers happen to have the courage to file an OSHA complaint, most employers are unlikely to ever see an OSHA inspector.
Yeah, it's crazy. Now, as I said, you're the guy who keeps up with all of this stuff at jordanbarrett.com/confinedspace. You know, walk me through some of the tragedies that happened last week.
Well, last week, I mean, actually, the most recent, I've been on vacation for a few weeks, so the most recent report was, I think, covered at least 2 weeks. There were a surprising number of electrocutions, and a lot of these were workers who were working on recovery after tornadoes and other natural disasters and hit power. You know, they were taking down trees or working on top of houses and hit power lines and were electrocuted. There were a couple. One worker died from in inhaling hydrogen sulfide, I think in some kind of sugar manufacturing establishment. Another one was killed in an explosion. There are always every week numerous truck drivers who are killed, law enforcement officers who are shot, construction workers who fall off of buildings, which in this case, and construction workers also on the highways that are hit by vehicles on the highways. I think there was a confined space death over the last couple of weeks. There was at least one heat-related death. A number of these, and a number of these, you know, happen every week. Every week you see more or less the same kind of construction deaths. Every week you see highway workers getting killed on the working on the highway. Very often explosions and falls and that type of thing. So, you know, it's nothing new. Unfortunately, it happens every week. And again, we don't even really know that much. I mean, the statistics say about 100 workers are killed every week on the job from traumatic injuries, as you mentioned. I have about 100 different Google searches out there for every possible kind of, worker tragedy, trying to look, you know, at whatever I can. I usually only come up with about 20 or 25 a week. So that means there's still about 75 out there, that either are never reported in the press, or are somehow so obscure that I can't quite locate them. But, we know that even as upsetting as the reports I do every week are, they're only the tip of the iceberg in terms of daily workplace tragedy in this country.
And that's why I said, I think what you do is so important because you bring it to light. I don't remember the last time I saw a story in my local newspaper that talked about an injured worker or any of this stuff. Unless, as you point out, it's one of the big things that you just can't avoid. You can't not report about. But someone falls off the roof while doing a roofing job. That's not going to make the news. You're not going to have a beat reporter go cover that. So it just gets like it never happened. And so that's why I think what you do is important to get people to know that, look, it's still work is still a dangerous thing, and that we do need inspectors, regulations, oversight to ensure that our workplaces are safe so that at the end of the day, all of us get to go home.
Exactly. And that's why it would be great to have a much larger, for OSHA to have a much larger presence in the country, in the workplace than they have now. Without the constant fear that you may be visited by an OSHA inspector, there's not much, unfortunately, not much deterrent to cutting corners on safety.
And for me, this is one of those issues, especially for my union brothers and sisters who get up every day and work in many dangerous jobs. This is where this election in November, there is a clear difference between Donald Trump and his track record, and I think Joe Biden and their track record. Or am I wrong?
No, exactly. And I've had some criticisms of the Biden administration, but they've actually done some amazing things on workplace safety and health. I mean, if you look at the kind of penalties are much higher for the most egregious violators than they have been before. They have been making progress, on standards. Unfortunately, they have not issued as many standards as I would have liked, but they have been making progress on them. So they have been moving forward. They've issued some regulations, for example, just recently giving workers the right to choose their own walk-around representatives to accompany OSHA inspectors. Previously, it was really only union members that were able to do that. Now, just about any worker can do that, although, as usual, the Chamber of Commerce and their friends have sued OSHA on that. So we will see what happens on that. But they have been making some major advances, which will be unfortunately reversed or stopped, should there be a second Trump administration.
No, you're spot on. But here's what's concerning to me. I don't know if you've been paying attention to this. I'm sure you have been. But I look at a number of red states that are loosening child labor laws, Iowa, Indiana, a number of these states that are allowing, kids, children, to go into the workplace and do what we've deemed in the past to be dangerous jobs. So my concern is, while we're seeing, more than 100 adults every day losing their lives on the job, as we're loosening child labor laws, as we're getting that cheap labor back into the workforce, that exploitable child labor, I fear that goes up too.
Exactly. I mean, we're seeing that. We're seeing, kids getting killed in the workplace. They weren't quite kids, but I mean, there were several, workers in their early 20s, 20 and one 16-year-old actually that was killed in the workplace. In the report I just mentioned. So not only are kids going to get injured and unfortunately killed in some cases, but it also just disrupts their life. I mean, kids should not be working all night, which some of these kids are, and then expected to go to school the next day. This is not the kind of babysitting jobs or whatever that, we had when we were little. These are jobs that, unfortunately should be done by adults and kind of take over your life. So the last thing we need is more of that, especially in those states that have a labor shortage. That is not the answer, as one Wisconsin politician said, the answer to labor shortage is not shorter workers. And that's kind of what we're seeing here.
Now, could you, I mean, you're a little bit older than I am, but we're kind of the same generation-esque. Could you imagine this to be our reality, you know, 20 years ago, that we would literally and actually be talking about loosening child labor laws so that we can get cheaper labor into the workforce?
Yeah, exactly. It seems like we're going backwards. I mean, backwards. I mean, and not just a little backwards. It's like we're going a century back to children working. And again, it's not, you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's unscrupulous employers and that type of thing. And we always have had and we always will have unscrupulous employers. The most upsetting thing is you have politicians, as you mentioned, in some of these red states that are encouraging that and promoting it and passing laws to make it easier for that to happen rather than harder.
No, I just saw something from Iowa that they're gonna let 14-year-olds drive as long as they're driving to work. And I'm going, the 14-year-olds should still be riding their bike around in the neighborhood.
Right, right, right.
Not trying to figure out how they're going to get to work on time. I'm 100% opposed to it. And again, I come back to this election. Elections have consequences. Elections are important for rulemaking. And there's got to be a way for the federal government to step in and say, this isn't the direction we want the country to go. Because I think federal labor law oversteps state law, especially when you're talking about child labor. No?
Yes. Yeah, it absolutely does. And I think some of these, you know, I think you have Republicans, especially if they take over the administration again, that will be looking to weaken the federal laws, which will allow the states to, you know, do whatever they want. And so that's one thing to really fear, because the president, you know, on one hand, you know, assuming we have, you know, a majority, Democrats have a majority in at least one house, or at least, you know, enough to use the filibuster, should that still be around. You know, they can stop legislation, but the president has an enormous power to either issue new regulations or to repeal old regulations. And that's what we really have to fear.
No. And look, you know, I don't know if you've been paying attention to the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025.
Yeah.
And the statements by Trump that he's going to use this thing called Schedule F to basically wipe out all the employees of the federal government and, you know, basically making patronage great again. If you're a good loyalist, if you've kissed the proverbial ring, we're going to bring you in, especially if you want to destroy whatever it is we're putting you in charge of. So it seems to me that come November, we've got a serious choice to make, given what we're being told they want to do. And the stuff that they tell us they want to do is pretty bad.
Yeah. And you know, that's not, I mean, the Schedule F and you know, the impact that'll have on the civil service is very upsetting. The other thing that's upsetting is now, you know, Trump and these Project 2025 people are claiming that the president also has the power to withhold funding from agencies despite what Congress provides. So that could mean, you know, if Trump is unhappy with OSHA, he could just, you know, with the swipe of a pen, cut OSHA's budget by half. You know, there would be nothing stopping them from just wiping out whole agencies, despite the funding that Congress gives them.
So any of those things that would be helping working people, the NLRB, the OSHA, EPA, you know, any of that stuff, they could just gut the funding. Is that their argument?
Yeah. I mean, they're saying the president has power over what money to spend, even if Congress provides it. And that's what's been saving us over the years. At least, you know, Congress has managed to maintain funding to some of these agencies. But if the president then assumes the power just to cut the funding wherever he wants, you know, we're all in trouble then. Every agency is in trouble then.
So last line of questioning I've got for you then, because it sounds to me like this should be kind of a campaign issue. Hey, if you want to go home at the end of the day, if you want a safe workplace, seems pretty clear.
Yeah. Well, that's what I, you know, I've always said, you know, in my blog, in the introduction, you know, how you vote in November to a great extent determines the likelihood of you coming home from work safe and sound at the end of the day.
And again, I still have my union brothers and sisters who are wearing the red hats. Sad stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, Rick, but yeah, these are the issues, you're right, that need to be discussed more, and they're not. You know, we kind of have these vague discussions about immigration and inflation and stuff, but not enough discussion about, you know, how a Trump administration would impact your life on a daily basis, your life at work, your safety at work, your likelihood of you coming home safe and sound, and your children coming home safe from work.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is, just popped into my head, you know, 2 years ago, we did our Working Class Heroes tour, and we ended up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And we, you know, on our time off, we did the coal mine tour up there. They took us down in the underground 300 feet, and they showed us what conditions were like 100 and some years ago when this was a working mine. And, you know, the guy had turned the lights down and, you know, said, now imagine, you know, this is where you're working. It's loud. You're knee deep in muck of human feces and animal feces and the slurry from the coal and just all of this just horrible, cold, damp nastiness. And everyone's like, you know, oh, my God. And the woman behind me said, well, where was OSHA? And the answer was there was no OSHA. This is why we have OSHA, so that you don't work in those conditions.
Exactly. Yeah.
Seems simple to me. But Jordan, I appreciate the work you do. Hope folks will check out the website, jordanbarab.com/confined space. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. But Jordan, always appreciate the time.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. Always good to be here.
I want to hear your thoughts. A place where you work, are there unsafe conditions? Something that could be better? Something you want changed? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy tonight with scattered showers and lows in the low 60s. And more clouds around for tomorrow with areas of rain, highs low 70s. Shower and storm chances continue for Friday and Saturday, mid-70s Friday, low 80s Saturday. Right now it's 73.
100 days, 144,000 minutes. The countdown to the November presidential election is on, and Maggie Dawn is counting too as she continues her special segment, Biden's Top 100.
Having heard from each and every one of you, I should start talking about what President Biden is proposing us for his second term.
Biden's Top 100 continues. You're invited to be part of it too. Call or text the Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays starting at 2, across the Civic Media Radio Network and the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember last week we spoke with Culinary Union Secretary Treasurer Ted Papageorge about Trump's wild and, well, out of the blue campaign promise to tipped workers that we were no longer going to tax tips. And we got a ton of email agreeing with Ted's statements that, you know, one, asking, you know, why didn't Trump do anything while he was president? And two, doesn't he have a record of cheating workers, especially the kind of low-wage workers that we're talking about here? Well, evidently, he regurgitated this promise again recently in Detroit. No more taxes on tips. Which now seems to be kind of maybe a thing for the Republicans to make it look like they actually care about working people. I'm seriously doubting that. But here to share some thoughts on this topic with his most recent story, I've got Dave Jamieson here. He is a labor reporter over at Huffington Post, one of the top labor reporters in the country. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I got to tell you, I saw the clip from Las Vegas, you know, and it, for me, it was just one of those things that, yeah, you know, Las Vegas, you know, the Culinary Union is really powerful there. You know, the workers are really engaged. They're a political force to be dealt with. This is an issue that's important to them. You get it there. But now he's reiterated it in Detroit. So it seems to me that this is maybe something that they think that he thinks he's going to be able to divide, especially low-wage workers on.
Yeah, I was wondering when he first brought this up if it was just something he came up with on the fly and would move on and forget about. But that doesn't appear to be the case. Not only did he bring it up in Detroit, my colleague Arthur Delaney, who I co-reported with, was running around the Hill talking to lawmakers about it. And Republicans told him that this was like the one policy that Trump was really interested in when he met with them on Capitol Hill last week. So it's looking right now like it's going to stick around. Of course, like a lot of Trump ideas This one isn't fully fleshed out. You know, he's famous for saying, like, we're going to release details in a couple weeks. So I don't know how fleshed out it is or how much he's tried to, like, build an actual coalition, because this will require literally changing the tax code. Probably would have been a good time to do it when he actually changed the tax code as president. But the reality is a lot of tax stuff is going to be up for grabs next year when they have to, Congress has to go back and figure out, you know, what to do about some of these expiring, tax measures from the reform that was already done. So, you know, I think it'll actually be talked about. It is certainly a long shot.
Yeah, it's one of those things where when I first heard it, I'm going, well, I guess we'll be getting CEOs who are getting tips at some point because they're going to figure out how to use this. This pledge to destroy, you know, Social Security, Medicare, you name it. This is the way to destroy employment in this country. Another way, at least that was my thought. I'm curious yours.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's pitched as kind of free money. I mean, who doesn't want more money? Who doesn't want to be taxed less? But there's all kinds of problems that you know would very well arise from this. One being is just like, all employers like leaning even more into tipping. I mean, what we've seen in you know, the dining world is we have this pretty unique system here in the U.S. where, especially with the tipped minimum wage in so many places not moving at all for years and years, a larger and larger share of workers' tips are unpredictable and coming from the tipping side. And, you know, if you change this policy with the tax code, it would accelerate that. And we'd probably see employers, even, you know, outside of restaurants, wanting to move to a tip form of wages because they wouldn't be taxed. And we're already at a point, I think, where a lot of customers are annoyed with, you know, post-pandemic, growth in tipping and the tipping prompts, and you hear it called tipping fatigue or, you know, stuff like that. And a funny example is I was like recently bought a fishing rod online. And at checkout, the company encouraged me to tip their warehouse workers, which it's kind of like, what are we doing here? How about we just pay the warehouse workers like what they should be paid, you know, yeah, rather than try to have them, you know, bake gratuities into what they're being paid. So I think that's all stuff that would probably worsen if we saw this change in the tax code.
Well, I think what they also know is that a lot of people are going to be guilted into, well, you know, I guess a percentage. And that's a win for them, because I question whether they're going to actually share those tips or not. And, you know, a real quick story. When, you know, years and years ago, when my wife and I were first at the beginning of dating, she used to do these horse tours. You know, you take on trail rides and stuff with this big company. And I was a big brother to a kid, and we went up to take this tour. And at the end of it, you know, they give you an envelope and say, hey, you know, if you like the ride, you know, tip your tour guide. And I really liked my tour guide, so I left a fairly hefty tip in there, you know, just to show my gratitude or just being stupid. And it wasn't until years later that I found out she never got that tip. She had no idea that I left anything, because the company that they worked for took all the tips and then gave them like a week's vacation at the end of the year instead of all of the money that they were collecting, they were putting in their pocket, which is why when I give a tip, I put it in cash, usually in the person's hand or somewhere where they grab it, because I don't want the business putting it in their pocket. I want the worker getting it.
Yeah, and one thing, this was the whole point of the story I recently wrote about Trump and this issue, is that, well, while he was in office, when he had a chance to sort of do policies that could improve work for tipped workers, what they did was they tried to change gratuity law to give employers more control over workers' tips. And this created one of the, it was actually quite controversial at the time. Of course, it was buried under like even bigger controversies, you know, in the Trump years. But there was a real uproar about it, because the Labor Department even projected that if this Trump plan went through, that they would see a massive transfer, as they called it, from tipped workers to their employers. Because the way this proposal was written, it really gave employers wide latitude to decide what to do with tips, which is actually under wage and hour law is you know, there's firm lines around what you can do.
Yeah.
And it required Democrats getting involved and attaching a rider to, you know, to a spending bill to make sure that that employers couldn't pocket workers' tips under this new Trump rule. And another thing he did was he you know, made it easier for employers to pay workers, you know, the tipped rate for non-tipped work. You know, and a perfect example of this is like rolling napkins or you know, mopping the bathroom floors if you're a server at a restaurant. They wanted to make it easier to give you $2.13 an hour rather than the $7.25 an hour. And, you know, that was something Biden, rolled back when he came into office. So Trump has a record here on this issue of tipped work. And it's I don't think it's one to be proud of.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. And I got to imagine, as an employer himself, I'm sure if you dig back into a lot of the goings on at his casinos and those places, you're going to find a lot of shenanigans around this.
Well, I do recall during his first run, there was, you know, quite a lot of coverage of fights over debts with vendors, you know, through his various businesses, where lots and lots of people said that they'd been stiffed.
Yeah. No, but this is, again, one of these things where my mind goes, why are we talking about the lowest wage workers and using them as a political football instead of saying, hey, maybe we raise that minimum wage up so that number's higher, so that workers at least get a raise that they're guaranteed of, instead of a gimmick of, you know, hey, you might get to keep your tips. Because as I understand it, and help me here if I'm wrong, because it's been a while since I've had a conversation with a tipped worker about their conditions. But I seem to remember, you know, people telling me that they were taxed on 8% of their checks total. The assumption was they were going to get 15. They were taxed on 8%. So whether you paid them 0 or 15% or 20 or 30 or whatever, they were taxed at 8%. So it seems to me that you could move that number a little bit if that's the case. But I don't know about doing away with it.
Yeah, I mean, look, right now, tips are supposed to be reported as wages. And I mean, obviously we know that a lot of that is probably underreported because people, you know, don't fully report their cash tips. But I think these days the IRS has a pretty good handle on what any restaurant brings in because of the proliferation of, you know, of credit, of dining out on credit. But as you mentioned earlier, another you know, big facet of this is the payroll tax issue. And if suddenly you are not taxing what is it can be a pretty sizable portion of income, there's ramifications down the road, you know, for people when it comes to Social Security.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to this. Me, again, I want to see the bottom raised like anyone else. I want to see people be able to make a living wage. But not at the expense of destroying all of the programs that we need for workers. And really fundamentally, I think this, if this were to happen, you would change employment in this country really quickly away from traditional employment to everyone being a gig worker working for tips.
Yeah, I mean, I do think we could see a really, really dramatic change because of this. Another reason why I personally am not, you know, taking it too seriously, I've been, you know, obviously, like everybody, I've been plenty wrong about you know, Trump over the years, but this one does seem like quite a long shot.
So this the plan here is probably with that the replacement for Obamacare is what you're telling me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that plan is it's right around the corner.
Yeah, it's coming any day now. Take a deep breath.
I think they'll be rolling it out on Monday, I'm sure.
Take a deep breath. I do want to change topics real quick. I see that California has just fined Amazon something like $6 million for violating their state's new warehouse safety law. Any word on that?
Yeah. So California a couple years ago implemented this warehouse safety law where you have to disclose to workers, if you're operating a warehouse in the state, you got to tell your workers like what the productivity expectations are. And the whole idea is to prevent injuries so you're not cracking the whip on people and making them run like in the hamster wheel because they don't know what the quota is. And it's also to prevent people from having to work through their breaks and that sort of thing. And so this was the labor commissioner announced today that they just dropped, fines of nearly $6 million on Amazon for violations at two warehouses in Southern California. And, you know, when it comes to workplace safety violations, as you know, Rick, that $6 million is quite large, actually. You normally don't see federal OSHA dropping fines like that unless, you know, some people have died.
It's a big fine, but to Amazon, it's a rounding error.
It's true. It is a tiny rounding error. However, this could become a problem for Amazon. It's because it's not just California. New York also passed a law that's sort of based on the California one, where same thing. Workers have a right to know the productivity quotas, and so it's part of this broader, legislative pushback against, Amazon and what people see as a grueling or a capricious, work pace in these places where, I've talked to so many warehouse workers over the years and people who just one day, they were temping at Amazon or whatever, and then they were just fired. They didn't really know why. They thought they were doing okay. Amazon sent me a statement today saying, that they're appealing this, they're fighting the fines, and their claim is that they don't have a quota system. What they have is a peer-to-peer evaluation system. And what the labor commissioner replied to that was what you're describing is exactly what we're trying to stop here. You know, I think Amazon is saying we don't have like a firm number that everyone is held to. You're just sort of like, disciplined by a supervisor, or you're free to discuss how you're doing with your supervisor. What the commissioner is saying is like, people don't know what's going on, what they're being held to, and that's a big problem.
A peer-to-peer, explain that to me.
They did not go into it in great detail. I think what they're saying is that, people are not held to a uniform standard, that you are, that a peer, in this case, I imagine a supervisor, will have discussions with you on how you're doing and how your rate is. You know, their claim is that they don't actually have what we would consider quotas.
Yeah. You know how you solve this problem? Legislation and going about this is one way, but letting those workers unionize, getting them to sit down and hammer this stuff out on paper so that I actually know and I actually understand what a peer-to-peer system is, because I guess I'm confused, because my mind goes, is this something where you got 10 workers and five of them are producing at this level, so that's the new quota? You got a bunch of younger workers, the older workers can't keep up. I got a bunch of questions here.
Yeah, and I think just the most basic thing that a union contract would bring is a grievance procedure for this whole thing, where,
yep,
where the company would have to sort of better document, how someone is not doing the job, and if there was a dispute over it, there would be a grievance process where a worker could air their case. Of course, that's not what you have right now.
And finally, I got to get your thoughts on something else that just broke. The NLRB issued a new ruling on this Station Casinos case. What I'm guessing is the first order requiring the company to bargain under the CMEX framework.
Yeah, the CMEX framework was this big new thing the board did last year, where it's basically going to, make it easier for the board to order companies to bargain when they've broken the law during a union campaign. And there's been a few rulings from agency judges. There's been three so far where they recommend a CMEX order. This was the first time where the board issued a decision and weighed in and said there should be a CMEX order here. So it's a big deal. And as you know, Rick, I mean, the Culinary Union in Las Vegas has been in this many years battle with Station Casinos, real yep, ugly one, trying to unionize that place. They have, they've successfully organized so much of the Vegas Strip and downtown, and Stations has been a real holdout. So I think this is like another legal win for them on that front. And it's a pretty big deal. And I'll just note, I didn't know this until I read the decision when it came out, but a great detail in there is a couple of days before the election, Station Casinos gave everybody free steaks that had been branded "Vote No." burned right into the stakes.
Wow.
And there's nothing, there's no violation inherent in giving away a free steak. But what the board said was that they were, that workers had identified the quality of the food they were given at work as a major source of, as a top concern for them. And the company here was basically trying to say, vote no, and you're gonna get steak.
Yeah. For how long? That's the question that I would have with this. But real quick, for those who don't know what the CMEX framework is, real quick, can you walk me through it?
Yeah, sure. So it's a little complicated, but you know, the short version is that now when a majority of workers sign union cards, they go to management and say, we desire to have a union. The company then has a choice. They can either say, okay, you have the numbers, we recognize the union, let's bargain. If they don't want to do that, they have to file a petition themselves to hold a union election. So then a union election is held, and if it's documented that the company commits unfair labor practices that warrant setting aside the election, they can be ordered to bargain. So a lot of times now you'll see like a rerun election, like where the company kind of messed with things and the vote was tainted. You got to go back and redo things. Here, the board will just say, you're going to bargain.
No, this is what I've been saying for a very long time. We absolutely desperately need, after what happened in Alabama at Amazon, you know, I was saying this should be the case where that is the way things works. I'm glad to see we're finally moving in that direction. Maybe the next time Amazon does what they did before, maybe it'll happen. But Dave, I appreciate the time. As always, great reporting. Love the work. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. Great talking with you.
Good stuff. Dave Jamieson, labor reporter there at Huffington Post. You want to check out his work? We'll get links out on social media. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1865. That was the day that 2,000 Union soldiers marched into Galveston, Texas. With them, they carried the news that those enslaved were now free. The Confederate General Robert E. Lee had actually surrendered more than 2 months earlier. Why then was there a delay in delivering the news of emancipation to Texas? It might have been that there were not enough federal troops to enforce the order. It has also been speculated that freedom was postponed to allow enough time for the enslaved workforce to harvest one last crop of cotton before freedom. Whatever the reason, General Order No. 3 finally was delivered. It read, quote, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with a proclamation of the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection existing between them becomes that between employer and free laborer." On hearing of the news, the newly freed people celebrated. The next year, they celebrated again in a holiday that became known as Juneteenth. In the years that followed, the holiday spread to other cities. But in the segregated South, black residents were often barred from holding Juneteenth events on public land. That is why in 1872, several black men in Houston purchased property and established Emancipation Park as a space to hold the celebration. In 1980, Texas became the first state to formally recognize Juneteenth. Today, this holiday is celebrated in black neighborhoods across the country, with gatherings, barbecues, songs, and remembrances of the fight for freedom. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, still, it boils my blood. It's got to be almost 30 years ago that tip incident happened with my wife. And look, you know, I still remember because it makes me angry. But I had taken my little brother through Big Brothers Big Sisters, which I'm a huge supporter of, and I think people should, if you have the time, take on a little. Changed my life as a child. And also as an adult, so I've seen it from both sides. Huge supporter. But, you know, took him on this trail ride. You know, hey, we're going to go up into the woods and we're going to ride, you know, mules and, you know, hit it off with my future wife at the time. And, you know, I figured I'm going to be a big tipper here. And it wasn't until years later that she told me, no, you handed me the envelope. And they were watching with, you know, from inside the office to ensure that she handed that in. And they never got a dime of that tip money. And this is one of those reasons I've always been against tipping. I think that workers should earn a solid wage. I think you should be paid for your time. It shouldn't be based on the generosity or the if you winked and nodded or smiled enough. I think workers should be guaranteed a fair wage, a consistent wage. Their work has value. It should be compensated as such. And for me, eliminating the tipped wage would ensure that all workers receive a minimum wage that allows them to support themselves and their families. But that said, every time I bring this up, I get people who are, you know, no, we have to defend it. And because look, some people do better in a tipped situation. Most workers end up, you know, being where the employer puts their risk. Because understand, the tip system is an unstable system. The income instability that comes out of it, because incomes fluctuate from week to week, day to day, month to month, and you can't plan a life around the generosity of others. And wage theft is huge in this. As I said, you know, the people stealing your tips, your employer maybe pocketing some of them, or hey, you came out of a credit card, we're going to charge you the fee of your tips. It's crazy what we allow to happen to working people. And then you look at the system, you talk about the gender and the racial disparities, and you know, who are tipped workers? They're majority women, majority minorities. That's creating an environment, a workspace, where employers have the ability to, well, cheat, enrich themselves at the risk of others. And for me, getting rid of it would be just simple, and it would be fair. The simplicity of it, you don't have to have some complicated system of, oh, did you declare all of your tips? Do we take a percentage of your checks? Do we do all of these things to ensure that Uncle Sam gets his due, but still allows people to keep money in their pockets? So for me, just ending the tip system. See, I was always taught that a tip was for exceptional service. You do really well, you tip somebody, hey, thank you for that. Not as part of their living. Now, I've always been a very generous tipper. It's one of those things that I try and do when I can, when I've got cash in my pocket. I always try and leave cash so that, well, they don't have to declare as much as I'm giving. Because I understand it's a tough job. It's a difficult job. It's a job that a lot of people don't want to do. And, you know, it's tough for people to make a living. But, you know, there are some people who make good tips in the higher end restaurants, and they want to keep it right where it is. But the fact that the argument for keeping the tip system is mostly around employers, you know, it's a cost control for employers. You know, they don't have to bear the brunt of the risk of paying that pesky minimum wage. You know, it have a and don't forget, Rick, it would have a huge impact on small employers. And this is, again, that argument that is being made. You know, you talk about wanting to keep mom and pop around, and I do. I think consumers should be going to mom and pop an awful lot more than we do. Put down the Amazon, go to Main Street. But there's a better way of ensuring that mom and pop can be competitive than doing it on the backs of low-wage workers. And that's always been my position. There's got to be a way. We're smart. We can figure this stuff out if we wanted to. And to have someone like Trump say, we're just going to do away with it, that doesn't solve the problem of people still living, you know, tip to tip, handout to handout. And for me, the rationale of all this is work should be respected. I don't care what you do. Work should be rewarded. I don't care what you do. You should be able to make a living on the work that you do. Seems simple to me. But I want to hear your thoughts. You got any tip horror stories? I most certainly want to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you got any questions, comments, something on your mind, there's where you email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the show or any of our programs, podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours, or just go to thericksmithshow.com, all right there. Also, freespeech.org for our video content. Highly suggest heading over there as well. As always, appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.